All right, let's talk about some news this week. So, Mark, you've had a killer week with stories. I was looking at our list, and it's not because you're joining us for a few minutes today, but it's because just the stories this week, most of them begin with Bloomberg. The biggest thing we want to talk about is the ARM transition for Max, which we now believe will begin at WWDC later this month. And that's because of your reporting on that. So it's been, you know, signs for years, but no one's really known like when. And so you've got the answer to that, which is as soon as WWDC, right?
Yeah, no, and thanks for having me. You guys are awesome as well, obviously. And I'm glad to see 9to5 is still kicking butt. ARM Max, the plan is to announce it as early as the developer conference. Obviously, I have to give that caveat, but it's going to happen at WWDC. They'll announce the preview there, and they'll start shipping the first Max next year. I think it won't be early next year. It'll be a little bit later in the year, maybe between April to later in the year time frame, maybe towards the middle of the year. We'll see. It's still fluid. As we've written, as you guys have written, this is because Intel has been dropping the ball significantly. This has been an ongoing thing where they've had supply chain issues. I'm sure, you know, you guys remember way back in the day that you would get Mac upgrades with big speed increases maybe every 6 to 9 months. These days, Mac updates are far and few in between because the Intel processor upgrades are just very minimal at this point.
Yeah, there was a time, 2012, 2013, where Apple was kind of dropping the ball on it delivering, you know, hardware upgrades of its Macs, and everyone was like, the new Intel processors are out, why isn't there a hardware revision? And Apple was just like dragging its feet, but more recently it's been the other way around, where, you know, Apple's been releasing updates, but the processor increments year on year are very, very small, just because the Intel chips haven't changed very much in a long time.
That's right, and I need to interject. Zach, you know what I'm going to say. Where's your subscription to Bloomberg?
I mean, I'm in private mode, aren't I?
Private mode. I'm sure Seth would pay for a Bloomberg subscription. Seth, if you're listening to this, you should.
Maybe we have one. I don't even know.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. Obviously, this is going to be the most significant new thing at WWDC. I mean, as you guys have reported, the WWDC updates for iOS, pretty minimal. Mac, pretty minimal. I think Watch will be some of the bigger updates that people will focus on. So ARM is going to be the big thing. I'd be interested to see what they call the chips, if they name them at the conference or not, or if they just say, hey, we're dumping Intel.
Yeah, probably this, like in June, they're just going to announce the transition, right? So stuff like final marketing names on chips probably won't be there. Like they'll probably save that because they don't want to Osborne all their current products too much, right? They just kind of want to get the technical information out to the developer community, right?
Well, let's chat about that for a second. So, yeah. Mark, would you buy a new Mac knowing this? I mean, it seems to me that we'll probably see some new machines there that we work on Macs now that are not ARM and that we'll need to for a while, and that this is kind of a long play. Like you mentioned, maybe spring next year. So what do you think about buying a new Mac now?
I wouldn't buy a new Mac until the ARM ones are out. But I guess the transition for laptops will be happening sooner than desktops.
Hmm.
Truth be told, I don't know if I would, like at this point, like if they weren't moving from Intel, I don't know if I would ever really buy another Mac again, right? I mean, I like the iPad Pro with the keyboard, but I got the 16-inch MacBook Pro, which I'm actually on right now. Hmm. When did it come? Like October or November last year. I got the base model 16-inch. It's pretty expensive. 16 gigabytes of RAM is absolutely not enough to pretty much do anything on a Mac at this point. Like, I know, you know, talking about RAM upgrades and MacBook Pros is so small right now, given everything else going on in the world. But, you know, I guess friendly advice, if you're already buying one of these, I would go for the 32 gigabytes of RAM. Mm-hmm. I wish you could do third-party RAM upgrades because the Apple pricing for their memory is beyond overpriced. But such is the reality. So my point being...
Apart from when they misprice it.
Apart from... That was ridiculous.
That was actually insane.
Ridiculous. Point being, I don't have those issues on the iPad Pro. And I think that comes down to the processor. So belief is you won't have those issues with the ARM Max.
Yeah, the excitement about the MacBook 16-inch for me is that we've kind of returned to a reliability state that we're in 10 years ago. So it's a big relief, but it's not like a, wow, we are moving. This is not where I would have guessed that we would have been, I suppose.
Yeah, so on obviously on the device like iPad and iPhone, it's all on a system on chip, right? The A-series has the RAM, and it has the RAM memory and the CPU inside it. But right now for... obviously the Mac stuff, the Intel CPUs are separate, and then you have dedicated, like, not then in the old days sticks around, but now they're soldered on the board. So if you're moving to an ARM base, is it going to be a SoC or is it just going to be the processor? Do you know what I mean?
It's a system on a chip, just like on the iPad. So my assumption is the RAM will be soldered in however they normally do it on the iPad. It's going to have the Apple GPU in there as well as the neural engine and whatever else they do. So I'm looking forward to more details at the conference.
Yeah, I hope we get step tracking from the Macs and you carry on all day. And...
you know, it's just, yeah, especially if you get one of those. I mean, this MacBook Pro 16-inch is not light.
You should get credit for working out with it.
Well, like, you can put a sensor in there and you can sort of use it as like a, I don't know, a bench press.
That's right. It gets lighter over time, but
yeah,
it makes you work for it. Let's shift gears a little bit, because you've also had a story this week too, by my count, that were about the reopening of Apple Park. So it's kind of a weird situation. You know, we've got COVID-19, specifically which closed Apple Park for the longest time, which made this WWDC virtual, and now we're about to, you know, experience that in a couple of weeks or less than a couple of weeks. But happening all at the same time is sort of the initial phases of going back to work at Apple Park, right? So how's that going?
Okay, so this is an interesting one. So a memo went out the other day about June 15th being the phase one reopening for the Apple Park campus, saying, you know, people will start coming in there. But the reality is, between us, not really between us, I've written this many times, people were there for the entirety of the COVID-19 situation. They've been ramping up, bringing people back. So I guess this is just like an official date they're putting out. I mean, they know these things come out and leak and whatnot. So that's basically putting an official date into the atmosphere. But the truth of the matter is there's been people there for quite a bit of time.
Yep. And then there were some neat details that you had that, you know, just in terms of what they write, that will be the guidelines, things like, I think one of them I thought was interesting was not taking the elevator.
Reducing the amount of people that can be in an elevator at once. Yeah. They're also doing nose swab testing, which is sort of like, there's three types of different coronavirus tests. I'm sure you guys are familiar, right? You can do the antibodies via blood work. You have the mouth cotton swab, which is what I did. And then you have the one that goes into your nose. It feels like it's touching your brain. So Apple's doing the third one. I know someone who just got it earlier and they said it was quite painful. They're highly recommending it, highly encouraging it, but obviously it's, I don't think by law they could necessarily require it.
Okay, so this week Happy Hour is sponsored by CleanMyMac X. It's an all-in-one clean and optimizing software solution for your Mac. It's a single package that combines the most useful features for spring cleaning your computer. You can scan for outdated junk files, easily work out what is using up all your hard drive space. It makes a visual virtual map of how your storage is distributed across all your files and folders. You can declutter old cache files, logs, mail attachments that you no longer need, and so much more. It detects it all, and you can potentially save gigabytes of space with a single click. Unfortunately, when you remove a Mac program, you know, sometimes it leaves a little clutter around preference files, caches that your computer just no longer uses or needs. Not everything's in the Mac app store, unfortunately. It's not that simple. And CleanMyMac Mac 10 can come to the rescue. It's designed to be super easy to use. The app will show you step-by-step explanations for every component, and you can be fully confident in the tweaks that it's making. It also features a system report menu, so you can get a dashboard of stats like CPU usage, free space, used RAM, and anything else. Like, if you've got 16 gigs of RAM, you can see it all being used up. The menu is beautifully designed, and it offers a sneak peek at the state of your entire system. So visit macpaw.com/podcast to download CleanMyMac X today and use coupon code HAPPYHOUR to receive 5% off. That's macpaw.com/podcast. Upon visiting, click the Buy Now button and then scroll to the bottom of the screen to enter the code before completing your purchase. CleanMyMac X is also newly available in the Mac App Store. Thanks to MacPaw and CleanMyMac X for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, you guys can Apple Cash me a third of that MacPaw.
Totally. Just quickly, before we go on to the iMac, so The ARM situation is interesting, right? Because when they first did the Intel transition from PowerPC to Intel, it was announced in what, like June 2005? And then by a year later, they'd moved every single product, right? And that's probably not going to happen here, because if they're announcing it now and they're not going to release the first laptop, presumably in what, like the springtime of 2021, there's a lot more of the product lineup that they're not going to get through in the same time frame.
Yeah. I don't think this is going to be done by the end of 2021. It was interesting because I went back and watched the Steve Jobs portion of that keynote, and he's like, this is going to be a 2-year transition, mm-hmm. 1 year. I think that goes back to your point about, one, them wanting people to buy the current Macs. People might be like, oh, wow, it's going to take 2 years. I'll keep helping buy this Intel iMac. The other point is, it's like, it gives them headroom in case there's delays. So.
Yeah.
I think on that front, there is a good case for people who probably should not use the first ARM Macs until software is figured out. And then there are people who would be great candidates for using that instead of what we have now. I mean, there's such a big difference in the way a Mac performs, a MacBook performs, the way an iPad performs. I mean, that's what makes the iPad Pro with the smart keyboard feel so futuristic, is it's not overheating all the time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't die within like 4 hours.
Yes, it does. The battery is not great with the...
Well, yeah. Yeah, and it's but at least it's not a steaming metal plate, you know. I mean, it's wild.
An iPad.
Yeah. Like my MacBook Pro, I enjoy it. Like it gets my it enables me to do my work. But it is hot. It is noisy. And you know, it could be more modern than it feels.
You've reported, right, that they're exploring emulation options, but you haven't said definitively, correct? That's...
Yeah, they were looking at emulation. I'm not sure what they're going to end up doing. There'll be a developer kit, a transition kit announced at WWDC. It's quite an interesting solution, what they're going to do. I haven't reported what it is yet, but that is coming. You know, the interesting thing to me is that I think the Apple developer community, for the most part, gets up to speed pretty quickly for things they like. For instance, like when the iPhone screen size is increased, a lot of developers seem to quickly move to mail. What's it called? The whatever, to let the screens adjust to the size.
I think auto insets. Yeah.
Auto layout.
Yeah. Developers move to that quite quickly. And then you look at Catalyst, which has just been a disaster in terms of developers moving. And it's like,
Apple's own apps.
Yeah. Apple's own apps. You look at the Twitter app and it's like, I still see the iOS settings in there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me, is there a way, like, is that a Twitter issue? Is that a Apple issue? Like, could Twitter tweak their Catalyst app to not show the iOS push notification settings?
Right. It's complicated, but if you were just doing like the way Apple intends you to use it, right? So not going off the board, kind of what like Stephen Trout and Smith kind of hacks around with. If you go straight, there's no way to do it. It's insane.
Interesting.
Yeah, like a lot of Catalyst is just not ready for prime time, and you see plenty of holes in the apps that Apple ship. The only Catalyst app that I think is of any respectable quality is the podcast app. And that one, Apple uses loads of internal private APIs to actually make it any good. Like
across the board, part of the ARM transition, right? So like
this it's irrelevant, right? Like the Catalyst apps, unless they can get to a point where the binaries are truly identical, which originally you reported like this 3-year plan where they're eventually going to get there, right? That's the only way that's only going to tie into ARM is if they can basically say, like, when you make your iOS 15 app, you can just tick one box and we'll ship it to the Mac App Store for you, right? Like that, and that would give them ARM options. But in general, just all the apps currently on the store today are going to have to recompile, regardless of whether they're made with Swift UI, Catalyst, or AppKit. It doesn't matter.
The ultimate goal is that every app that runs on iOS, I'm talking first party, and I guess they're pretty well, every app, every feature, every framework, is going to become platform independent, right? Mm-hmm. Be one code base across everything, and the only difference will be the hardware and the input methods. That's going to take a while. I imagine that'll be 2023, 2024 to get the entire thing completed. But what you'll see at some point in the next 3-4 years is basically an Apple that fires much more quickly on software because everything is basically the same. And
they're not redoing stuff 3 times over, right?
Right. Hardware is just a conduit to a single software code base.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that we're in the year 2020 and that's not really the case, not only for Apple, but for any software hardware company.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see limitations, right? And why it's hard, because their current options, which like the Catalyst apps are easy to make, but they don't work very well and they don't look great and they don't fit into the platform. Like that's the problem with all of these like cross-platform solutions, is that when you actually get down to the nitty-gritty, the UIs kind of have to be written independently. And so it's been like, I think you see it in like proof in the pudding, like all the Catalyst apps look like iPad apps and they feel like iPad apps when you use them. They don't feel very Mac native. Like you can click on stuff, but it feels like if this was actually designed from the Mac's perspective, it would look very different.
Yeah. Right.
So it is a hard problem. And they're coming at it with Swift UI. And they, even in the like the sessions for Swift UI but last year, they were basically admitting like, if you want your app to work perfectly on every independent platform, you're gonna have to write separate code. And they're trying to make it so that the lower levels, the frameworks and the foundations of your app can be shared across everything. But when you get to the UI layer, you're never gonna get anything that's like truly good unless you've written, you know, separate things for each platform.
Yeah, no, yeah. Totally right.
Yep. All right, you guys want to talk about the iMac?
Go for it.
All right. So the first way we came across this was we were talking with the source, and it was the night before your Big Arm story came out, and your Arm story kind of made what we were looking at just totally irrelevant, because it was like, all right, there's definitive versus the speculation. But there was one nugget in that context that was about a T2 iMac, right?
Correct.
And that was as specific as it was. And then we were looking at like, you know, it's interesting. That's a story on its own, because so far we've had iMacs with no T2 chip, and that's meant that there's been these fusion hard drives and spinning disk hard drives, and that's just really bad for expensive computers in this current time. And so we were looking at that, me and Mayo, and then we saw that Sonny Dixon's tweet. It was just like, you know, here's a big spec drop of like what he believes will be coming at WWDC. It's one of those things where it sounds too good to be true, but also it's so overdue that maybe there's something to it. But Mayo, can you kind of recap what we're looking at here?
Sure. So Dixon said to expect a new redesigned iMac at WWDC, which would kind of co-opt the iPad Pro design language, which mostly just means, you know, thin bezels. He refers to the Pro Display XDR, which basically likes any if you ignore the screen quality, the bezels aren't anything to write home about, really. They're just like the average expectation for the modern era. But then you look at the iMac and it looks like the super old hardware with a massive forehead and a massive chin and massive black bezels around. And then that would obviously come along with a 2T chip, which implies that it's going SSD only, because the T2 chip doesn't work if you've got hard drive options. And that's why all iMacs to date haven't featured the T2 chip. So even if you buy configured 2019 iMac with an SSD, it doesn't use the T2 chip for speed and performance and security. It just uses the older methods. But finally, they're going to get onto, you know, a better platform here, as well as GPU upgrades. And they're going to, that obviously means Fusion Drive will go away, the standard hard drive will go away. But you should have fingers crossed after what, like a decade of the same design. Like behind me here, I have the 2010 iMac, which if you look at it face on, is identical to the iMac that ships in 2019. Because only in 2012 did they change it so that it tapers down to like the 5mm bezel, 5mm thickness on the chassis at the side. But if you actually look face on, the design hasn't changed in a decade. So it's been a long time coming, but seems like that's what's going to happen. I don't know what you think about it, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I just know there's going to be a redesigned iMac this year. WWDC certainly possible.
Yeah,
I think that's when it would be. I'm curious what Apollo Zach thinks.
Well, I mean, I think interesting too to add to this is the context of what do we know about Sonny Dixon? You know, I mean, he's a pal of all of ours. He's had stories in the past that, you know, I think the last major one I can think of, I was having my wisdom teeth removed and I came back and then there was this Sonny Dixon tweet that was like theater mode. And it was thought to be about the iPhone, but it was about the watch. So it was like pretty close there. You know, so but he's got a history of, you know, finding nuggets here and there. So it's not like, you know, some random person on the internet. It at least comes from a place that we can, you know, give some track record to, right?
I wouldn't bet against.
Yeah.
There's people I would bet against, but
certainly. Certainly. I mean, yeah, when you do this for nearly 10 years, or in your case, probably over 10 years, then you kind of see the patterns over time. And there's a layer that you don't see on the surface that, and that's not here.
So. And I mean, it really is time, right? Like, if they're going to announce the ARM transition at WWDC in 2 weeks' time, they kind of need to, like, get all their computers on up to speed on the old architecture, right? Because otherwise they'd be announcing the ARM transition before the iMac even got a coprocessor, like an Apple coprocessor, right? So this is like the last chance they could even do it.
That's right. The iMac doesn't have a
Chromebook. Yeah. Yes, because it never transitioned to SSDs only. The T1, T2 chip required SSDs only, so they never did it.
You did not know that.
Yeah. Because you buy an iMac with the SSD option, like you spec it up, and it doesn't drive it off a T2 chip.
It's like the iMac Pro at $5,000 is like what the iMac ought to have been in the last few years in line with the other Macs, because it isn't like the MacBook Air is a super premium thing. And it got, you know, T2.
Yeah, the iMac Pro is T2, but the baseline iMac range doesn't.
Right. So you've got to spend $5,000 to get it. And it's been that way for since 2017, right? Like the end of 2017, that you've had to have a modern sort of, even just internally redesigned iMac, then you need to have the Pro version at $5,000 and up. And so it's like finally some of those elements will come to the consumer iMac, and then also a new look. I mean, that's a big deal for the iMac because it has this long, you know, overdue design change that needs to be changed.
So, what are you guys thinking about iOS 14? What are you most excited about?
14. Do we know anything about it? Shoot, I don't know.
Well, we covered like the obviously they're from the leaked build. We talked about the home screen list view option, right? Where they're going to, we think, put something different on the home screen, although that might have been deferred till next year. I'm not sure. Like, there's been some random reports of lesser provenance about they're going to move widgets from the today view back to multiple pages, which would be nice, right? Like, I don't think you need crazy flexibility, but to be able to move some widgets of different, and especially widgets different sizes, because right now on like the today view screen, all the widgets are basically that fixed size all the way down, unless you expand them, and then like you kind of want like button size widgets and stuff, but we haven't had like a smoking gun leak if that's actually happening yet. There's just been some like random stuff online, so I'm not actually sure what the status of that is.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff you guys wrote is happening. Some of the stuff was, from what I'm told, some of the stuff was just like, obviously, I mean, this sounds PR-ish, but like it's a picture in time, right? Like that was from December, November.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we reported based on that December build was the cursor support, which ended up shipping sooner, right? Because that shipped in 13.4 instead.
Yeah. I thought that was the biggest one out of all the stories.
I think the biggest one is wallpapers for CarPlay. I hope it ships.
You're like the only person. You know what? You're the type of person that would buy an Apple Watch just for the Apple TV remote app. Here's a story about Zach.
I know what you're going to say, and this is a great story.
iOS 7?
It's about iOS 7 and you bought the white iPhone, right?
So we're in the hotel and like they announce iOS 7 and Zach was like, wow, this looks really great on a white iPhone. And it's not even that. It's just because Apple just uses the white iPhones in the marketing. So Zach decided it looked better on the white iPhone.
And obviously this was June 2013. So we all knew there was going to be the 5S coming out in three months. Yeah.
3 or 4 months.
So anyway, you'd already reported about Touch ID. I'm pretty sure at that point.
Probably.
Yeah.
Remember, but so what? Zach goes across the street to the Union Square Apple store. Actually, it wasn't across the street at that point. It was down the street where I think the T-Mobile store is now on Market. And he just goes and buys a secondary iPhone 5, white iPhone 5, like it's nothing, just because iOS 7 looks better on the white phone.
Having already owned a black iPhone 5.
Having already owned a black iPhone 5.
Forgot about that. Yeah.
Mark, that Zach originally bought an iPhone 11 last September, and we spoke about it on this show, about how it definitely wasn't going to last, and he was definitely going to go up to the Pro model eventually, and within about 2 months, he'd gone to iPhone 11 Pro, and then by, like, January, he was on iPhone 11 Pro Max.
Oh, yeah, not surprising.
Yeah,
yeah, and then a few...
Actually, didn't you change the iPhone 11 just because what color it was? I'll take that as a yes. Yeah.
I'm on an 11 Pro white today, so if that helps.
Point being... There's one thing Zach likes more than NASA and space, and that's Apple.
Well,
especially they come in different colors.
CarPlay won't be a factor. I drive a motorcycle now. So, you know, unless you know something about motorcycle CarPlay.
Oh, wait. Speaking of CarPlay, you were also the first person I knew who had a car with no CarPlay, bought like a third party add on to add CarPlay to your car.
Yeah, I think me and Seth went in halves on that. I think it was October 2014, and we had a CarPlay review, and it had to be like 2 or 3 years later when we started seeing those same types of things pop up. And there were people from like newspapers asking me, how do you take screenshots of CarPlay and all this stuff? And it's just like, this is a cool job. Get to do something.
While we got you, Mark, just really quickly, is there any update on like the home stuff? Because obviously they've got the home team working on accessories. You've got the HomePod stuff, right? Is that, that's an iOS 14 thing, the HomePod, like Spotify stuff?
Yeah, nothing new. Okay. Just smaller new HomePod.
Yeah, because that's one of the things I'd love to see. Like, I think the one of the things that you said on your Twitter live stream a few weeks ago was that after the HomePods, you know, flumped out the door, not to great success, right? You said that Apple had set up like a team dedicated to fix the HomePod, quote unquote, right? So I've been hoping that maybe this is the year when we actually see that come to fruition. Obviously, we've got the rumors of the HomePod Mini coming at some point.
It could be this year. By the way, what do you guys think of those live streams? Like me doing the Periscope, should I do more of them? Or is that a waste?
I think in this moment that we're in, where everyone has to be more apart than before, and there's so much stuff going on in the world, that any way to feel more connected is really cool. Like I was watching a rocket launch a few weekends ago, and it was the night before. I had a terrible view of like the pad from way far away, but I just did my first live stream ever and like barely spoke, but people joined and like commented and stuff. So I mean, that's what we're doing now. We're doing the second ever live video of Happy Hour. And it's not that there's like new technology to allow this, but I just think in this moment that we're all in, that the more that we can fill together, the better.
Especially in like high news seasons, like WWC month, you know.
And then Mayo watches to like scrape, you know, stories. So
no, I've watched Mark all the time anyway.
Yeah.
I was a big Gadgets with German fan.
For another time.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the HomePod, Google's countersuing Sonos. You know how Sonos had sued Google? You know, and they wouldn't sue Amazon because they didn't know if they could do two companies at once. They're getting countersued. So,
is that a joke about them taking so long to add assistant to the Sonos?
No, it's a true story. I'm trying to find out for the live watchers what the PS5 looks like, and that's what I'm seeing. Is
okay, I was gonna ask you guys. So, are we really doing this in the middle of the PS5?
Yeah.
So we had our schedule before they reached schedule theirs.
That's right.
Zach Hall and Ben Mayo, I would rather watch them any day than hear about some new PS5 game. So
I'd rather talk to you.
Unless it's like NBA 2K21 exclusive for the PS5. But.
There you go. Well, anyone who doesn't know, I mean, everyone knows Mark Gurman from Bloomberg and his previous time at 9to5 Mac, but I wouldn't have any place in this world that we're in like I do if not for Mark, because, you know, years ago I had a parody Apple Store account and, you know, a parody Apple News site and, you know, I don't know, it was the really, really weird extended April Fool's joke, but Mark, you know, and Seth gave me a job, and, you know, now I'm getting to do not just my dream Apple job, but now my dream job with like covering NASA and SpaceX. So, you know, I indefinitely owe Mark for that.
Well, first of all, that's very kind. It's certainly not true. I feel like anyone who's in the position they are today, or most people, is given an opportunity by someone. I mean, like, I was given an opportunity, and it's up to that individual, solely up to them, to either, you know, use the opportunity and do well with it or screw it up. And certainly you just made the most of an opportunity, just like everyone else in the world. So that's very kind, but you don't owe me anything.
Nice. I did give you a Publix gift card one time, though, if you recall.
Did. So Zach had something called like a humor budget.
Yeah.
And we had a coworker who worked at this grocery store. I think they're primarily in Florida. Who didn't
in Southeast,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, in Southeast Florida, who didn't like whenever, you know, Zach or me or whomever would, you know, tweet about Publix. And so that was sort of an inside joke that he sent me a $5 Publix gift card as part of his humor budget.
Yeah, man. The humor budget went a long way too.
That was a great group, honestly. 9to5, that was a great group. We had a lot of fun. We did a lot of good hard work.
One last thing. So, you know, in 13.5.5, the audio article stuff for Apple News is implemented, right? We had a video on it. Yeah. Of reactivating it. It's just hidden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You mean 13.6.
Sorry. The new
we haven't gotten there yet. Yeah.
We haven't gotten there yet. That's later on in the show. But presumably that's shipping then, like, soon, right? It's not really late.
I don't know. But okay. Assume that they announced that at WWDC.
They've done like Apple, because Apple Music, they announced at WWDC and then shipped it July, right? They didn't wait till iOS 9, they shipped it as like an 8.x update. So.
I have an idea. You know how they had Drake on stage to announce they have you two on stage,
yeah,
right? Like news stories.
I actually can't talk about it because of that reason.
Well, you know this fall when they introduce the second version of the ultra wideband chip, they're gonna have U2 in every iPhone.
This...
I don't get the
joke. Oh my gosh.
U1 chip.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
All right. Last thing, Mark, before we part ways, you've covered this story now where Apple's, you know, listening to China and removing these podcast apps. I think Castro is one, Pocket Cast, I think, is the other. And they've limited what podcasts are available in China at the government's request.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
You know, it's basically the Chinese government contacting Apple and telling them, hey, you need to remove this app. And Apple seemingly just removing them without really putting up a fight. And they're, what they've said, they haven't commented on this one, but what they've been saying, you know, for years is that they just follow the local laws in the countries that they operate in. And I'm not entirely sure how to argue that, because I guess it's a fair point. But on the other end, you know, Apple fights for so many other human rights.
Yeah.
You've seen the big $100 million announcement from Tim Cook today,
mm-hmm.
About racial equality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the situation in China with how they treat, you know, their citizens and the flow of information there has been a problem for many decades.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to equate the racial injustice problem in the United States and elsewhere globally to the sure. situation in China. I don't think it's an apples to apples comparison in any way. I feel like this one is far more important right now. But obviously the China thing is a real problem, and perhaps one day Apple will, you know, will say something. But it's sort of like when you're dealing with the Chinese government, it feels like you're dealing with a ticking time bomb. Whereas what if just like one day, you know what, Apple, just get the 42 stores out of here and, you know, you go do whatever, right? That's a big several billion dollar annual loss for Apple that would crush them in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as the chief executive, you kind of have in those shoes, I mean, it's quite an easy decision to make.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I would love to hear something to acknowledge it, how, you know, from Tim Cook, because look, this isn't an easy thing to do. This isn't what we ideally what we want to do, but this is how we move forward, and this is why to address it. Because I have seen over the past few weeks, as Apple makes different statements, they say, "Well, what about China? What about the app in Hong Kong? You know, what about protest?" And
because they fight so much stuff that, like, they fight they take the government to court over encryption stuff, right, in the U.S. and then.
That's the better comparison, Mayo, than the racial injustice situation then, right? Okay, I feel fair to equate the fight that Apple puts up in the U.S. versus the fight they put up in China. No matter what Apple says to Will Barr in the U.S. government, they're not going to be kicked out of the country.
Yeah.
So
yeah, whereas China, they're basically submissive to the laws of the country, whereas in the U.S., yeah, they follow the law, but they also fight them at any opportunity they get and try and change it, yeah.
Right. And who knows? You know, it's very possible Apple is putting up a fight against those companies.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they certainly the stuff with podcasts. It certainly affects them as well, because all their services aren't available in China either. Like, we just talked about the new stuff they're doing. Apple Music isn't available. The TV Plus stuff isn't available. The news service isn't available. So they suffer from the same censorship wrath there, right? Like, all their services, content services, which they're getting so much of their growth from, they're also not available there. And again, podcasts, their own podcast app is being restricted too.
So that's 100% agree with you, Mia. But like on the Apple podcast app, so the amount of content they have in the podcast app is severely limited compared to elsewhere in the world, or I guess compared to the US. No categories. My question is, why did Castro and Pocket Casts and whatever other podcast app are getting barred in China? Wouldn't have it made more sense if they had an opportunity to sort of choose, hey, do you want to restrict like us, or do you want to be removed?
Yeah, I think Pocket Cast said that they decided that they weren't going to fight at all, and they were just going to take a hard line. We're not going to comply with censorship at all. We're just going to leave.
That was my sense too. I just don't believe that was an option.
Sure, yeah. Like, obviously, when China came knocking to Apple last year to say, you know, the podcast stuff isn't in line, there was obviously a lot of negotiation that went back and forth behind closed doors, and they eventually we'll just limit the content availability, whereas these third-party developers don't get the same option. They just... you got to leave.
And who knows? There's possibly, you know, different situations and negotiations behind the scenes that we're not aware of right now. Definitely a very important topic to follow.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Mark, it's been so much fun catching up and talking. We should do this more often. That's what people say when they go away for a long time. Yeah. But actually, we should do this in the same cadence we're doing right now. We should do this about every once every year. How about that?
Is this the last time we did this a year ago?
Yep, just before the last WWC.
Oh. Well, I'm glad I'm the guy you guys wanted this year.
You've got the great stories, Mark.
I'm surprised you didn't have Ron Crozier on. Anyways, this was great.
Cheers, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Appreciate it. Take care.
This week, Happy Hour is also sponsored by Incipio, the iPhone case maker you all know and love. And obviously, Incipio has a full range of great cases for your Apple devices. But in particular, just recently, the company has launched its new Organicore collection of cases for the 2020 iPhone SE and more. So if you want to be environmentally conscious and just sport a really stylish iPhone case, Incipio Organicore is the answer. It's made of 100% plant-based and compostable materials, and it lets iPhone users reduce their footprint and their emission with a case that is designed to protect the planet as well as your phone. And because it's made of organic materials, it's 100% biodegradable in a compostable environment, and it will be disposed of in as little as 6 months naturally. The case is offered in 3 colours, black, deep pine green, and oatmeal beige. And as well as being good for the environment, it's still a great case offering 6-foot drop protection and raised bezels to help keep the front screen and the back camera out of harm's way. You can get Iconicore's cases for iPhone SE, iPhone 11, and iPhone 11 Pro right now. The entire lineup is available to buy for $39.99. Check out the full collection using the link in the show notes. Thanks to Incipio for sponsoring the show.
All right, cool. Let's talk about iOS 13.6. What is that, Mayo? I think it used to be a flavor of iOS 13.5, like how 13.5 was a flavor of 13.4. So where are we and how did we get here?
Yeah, it is. Apple's loving to rename its betas at the moment. So when they renamed the 14 point whatever, 13.4 point something into 13.5, the justification was that there was some new developer API, and that was the COVID-19 exposure notification tracking, right? So then they said, okay, we have to rebrand because, and we spoke about this on the show, the granularity to which a developer can specify availability of a new API is based on the X.X. You can't go to the X.X.X version. So presumably there must be new API in this version as well, because otherwise where else do we rename it? Although they also do renumber stuff just for branding and marketing reasons. And so we've seen the iOS 13.5.5 beta become iOS 13.6 beta this week. We expect this will be the version that Apple will officially announce as part of the WWDC announcement, and that will include the Apple News Plus audio article stuff. Outside of that, there isn't anything huge in this update. There's a few new data types in the health app for allowing you to log symptoms, and they have a new option in settings for software updates. Previously, the install automatic updates was just one toggle. And so that toggle would represent downloading the update and installing it. And so you could either do it all or you could do nothing. Now, for a reason I'm not entirely sure what they've done it, they now have split the options out into two. So as well as in turning the whole thing on and off, you can now tell it, download the update, but don't install it, or download or only install the update once you've downloaded it manually. So basically the option now is that you can choose if you want to have the phone automatically download an update in the background. So I think this might have come, bit them somehow with someone's, data plans or something. Maybe it was some legal thing that's happened in the last, 4 months, it's kind of gone under the radar, where customers were complaining that the iPhone was too aggressive in downloading, and these software updates can be hundreds of megabytes. So if you've got a low data cap, on your mobile plan, you can go over your limit just by downloading an update that you maybe didn't even want. So that's probably the justification for this being split out into two toggles now, so that a user can say, okay, I don't mind if you install the updates automatically, but don't download them until I explicitly tell you to.
Yeah. Have you successfully seen an automatic download and update occur on your device or family's devices?
They do happen. They definitely don't happen every single time, right?
Sure.
Often you'll get the thing where if you check on it, it'll say, this update will install later tonight. And so it tries to be careful and not try and disrupt your workflow too much by not just randomly updating in the middle of the day. The Apple TV, I've noticed, does just randomly update at the most random times. So obviously the Apple TV is permanently plugged into the wall, so it doesn't have the battery problem. So I think its algorithm for when it installs an update that it's downloaded is much more aggressive than what the phones or the iPads do, because the phones and the iPads wait until they're plugged into power. And so they have to use some machine learning model to predict what your daily usage patterns, right? So they don't start doing an update while you're unplugged. Whereas the Apple TV just goes ahead and does it. So a lot of the time when I come in to watch TV in the evening and there's just been an update, I'll turn on the Apple TV and then it's just on a loading bar screen. But for the iPhone and iPad, it's definitely rarer. I have seen it happen, and so I don't want to say it's like just completely not working, but there are definitely times when I feel like it's been plugged in for hours and hours and hours and a pending update was not installed.
Yeah, I kind of want to try it. I have it on devices, but I've not often seen it work. And so I wonder if like rejiggering this in the way it's now, at least the options
I'm
are.
I'm not sure if it works with wireless charging. You might have to have it physically plugged in.
Yeah, it would be for family. I don't think anyone in the family is using wireless charging, like my kids and my wife. But I'm thinking before I've seen, you know, once you get the badge, there's an update. And then, you know, you can it'll try to do it. But if it's not charging or something, it'll say like it failed, and then or it'll ask for permission in your passcode to do it overnight. And so it kind of feels like a two-step, very involved process still, not super automatic. So I wonder if it'll just get better with this process now that they've got the two toggles. Or if it's just that it works exactly the same way and there's a new way to turn something off rather than like it worked differently.
When you see Apple go from like one toggle to two toggles.
That's a big deal for Apple.
I kind of feel like the motivation isn't a consumer user experience, and somewhere along the line, there's a lawsuit in the air, right? Like that's what when I saw that screen, I was like, you know what, this looks a lot like a lawsuit defense rather than a user experience thing that they explicitly opted into. Like you'll probably find, and I tried to Google for it, but I couldn't find anything. You'll probably find somewhere like Apple is under fire for forcing people to use up their data plan or whatever from iOS updates downloading automatically. Like I bet there's something to do with that in the mix there, because otherwise I don't really get why they would have bothered. But
yeah, yep. And then with the Apple News Plus audio thing, I was thinking about that this week too, and I've seen some news outlets start to take advantage of just having an audio element of the story, whether it's just like reading it verbatim or just having a discussion around it. That's always kind of been what we use our podcast for, between 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour and 9 to 5 Mac Daily. And so much as like every single story as audio would just be so much work, but, we at least have the podcast to kind of wrap them up. But, I have seen like the New York Times do, here's an audio version of the text, you know, on certain stories. But they're not in News Plus, right? And so
they were one of the newspapers that Apple was reportedly trying to get in the run up to the service launching last year, but they didn't agree to the terms because they've got a pretty successful digital subscription business going on already, so they weren't super enamored with getting, you know, aggregated into a $9.99 subscription where they only get a share of half of it, right?
Right. Yeah. So, I think that's going to be a part of it too. Is that so? You do add a new way to interact with the service with News Plus audio. So if you don't have time or it's not your preference to read each story, you can have the audio version of the stories available within News Plus. But you're still limited to which papers and news outlets are in News Plus. So. It's kind of, I think it's an awesome idea and a cool feature to be added. The price is still difficult to work with, especially when if Apple takes half of that. You know, but maybe in time this will all develop in a better situation to have more news organizations within the service.
Yeah, it's kind of contradictory, right? Yeah. But say if they halve the price from $9.99 to $4.99. But all you could get was newspapers, right? And they added like 5 more big newspapers, like including like New York Times.
Yeah.
I think if you just had like Apple News Plus newspapers only, it would actually be more compelling than the $9.99 thing where you get, you know, the 4 newspapers and then 200 magazines, right?
I agree with that. Yeah.
Like, and if they do that and people only subscribe to the newspaper bit, the newspapers are going to make more money because there's less people to share it around with, right? So I think business-wise, it could possibly work out if they did something like that, and then maybe like if you want the magazines it's another $4.99 add-on or something. But I think we haven't seen anything that's going that direction. That was just an idea I had about the way they could shake it up. I think for this year they're just going to try with Apple News Plus audio. Mm-hmm. So it's like and the thing with the audio articles is that it kind of follows a trend that we've been seeing in the industry, right? Like I think a lot of outlets like the New York Times, we've seen digital papers do this too. Like the popular blog Stratechery started doing an audio version of his articles. Like I think this is them doing audio versions of the stories isn't just them like trying something random. It does follow a pretty big trend that's been going on in the industry, as like newspapers and editorial are trying to blend with the podcast world. And so they're adding these like premium spoken versions. So I think it has got a shot, and it'll depend on final implementation, who they've got on board, what actors they've got to speak the stuff, what voiceover rights they have. But, you know, it's a better effort than they did last year, let me put it that way. And from the leaks that we've had with the UI, the UI seems way better fleshed out than what the original News Plus experience was as well. So
It looks sharp right now, what we're seeing. And that's before it's released. So, and then finally, let's talk about iTunes U and iBooks Author. Both of these stories are things that have kind of, like, the writing has been on the wall in such a massive way for so long. And so Apple's finally coming out and saying, we're not going to do a new version of iBooks Author. We're not going to do anything with iTunes U. And so they each have their own kind of deadline for when they go away. But this is the week that they've said these aren't going to continue anymore, right?
Yeah, so iTunes U will continue for this school season, but it's going to go away by the end of next year. So they're giving, you know, a transition period for people to move along. But I mean, the writing was on the wall. Like, neither iTunes U or iBooks Author have been well managed or well updated for a long time. So the fact that they're getting just formally discontinued now is basically just admitting what we knew to be
true. The weird thing is that whenever Apple started pre-installing applications on iPhones and iPads, iTunes U, I think, was one of those. So they really wanted to promote it, you know, and it got the whole iOS 7 refresh, you know, 7 years ago now. But they didn't take it from there and ever do anything differently with it. And they've had the iPad Classroom event, and they've had the iPad Classroom app and that version for the Mac as well. And they kind of point to those as like new resources for schools and education. But iTunes U was always, it's kind of a big collection of podcasts in some ways, which is kind of its future, you know, is look for that content elsewhere. But
yeah, I think the vast majority of iTunes U content could just be like subsumed into a category of the podcast app, and most of it's already moved in that direction.
That's right. Yeah,
I actually learned iOS development from an iTunes U course. See, the Stanford iPhone development course is what I learned how to make iPhone apps from, and this was, you know, 2011 time. But even then, what was I watching? I was watching a video podcast, basically, right?
Right.
With some PDF materials that now could just be a link in the show notes. So, and iTunes U, if you used it properly, was a bit smarter than that, right? You could do scheduling, and you had a curriculum you could lay out. But most of those features now, they've funneled into the Classroom app, which is the main difference was iTunes U was like Classroom, but for the entire world, whereas Classroom's like specific to your organization. So you have to set up like the educational institution, you have to invite the schools with the managed Apple IDs to actually run it. Whereas the way iTunes U worked is it was more like freeform. It was almost like the equivalent to running a website, right? Anyone could just sign up and do it. Whereas Classroom is like specific to a school or specific to a business, right? So that's the only difference. But I think it makes sense to streamline it a bit, because there was huge overlap between iTunes U, Classroom, and podcasts. And iTunes U was the one not getting attention. Podcasts are really hot these days. So if they can just funnel some more content there, then that's fine. If you see what I mean, like, I don't think we're really losing out there. iBooks Author was a missed opportunity, right? They could have pushed iBooks Author a lot better, because it was introduced as part of the 2013 school event, which was kind of like what is now known as like the textbooks event, because they really tried to get textbook makers on board to release custom digital textbooks for iPad and improve the iPad learning experience that way. They never really got many partners on that. I think McGraw-Hill made some, but they weren't very popular, so they didn't continue it. And then the iBooks Author app, if you were an individual person, you could write a book in iBooks Author, but then you could only publish it to the iBook store, which meant no one really did it anyway, because obviously if you're a publisher, you want to get your book out to every platform, and so you don't want to be limited to a proprietary iBooks Author experience. So everyone would just write the book in an EPUB format, like an open book publishing format, and then submit it to the iBook store, but then submit it everywhere else. And iBooks Author did have some really nice features, but a lot of those now are just part of the normal EPUB standard, and you can get, you know, decent books through the Pages publishing features that they've added. So they have tried to add like compensation here, and they've even saying that in a future update to Pages from the iWork suite, you'll even be able to open and edit iBooks Author documents directly. So they are giving some like way for people to migrate forward. But the core like Because the biggest thing that set iBooks Author apart from just like making a Word document was that you could have fixed layout pages. So you could have like nicely designed two-page spreads with everything, you know, properly typeset and all the graphics and logos going in the right places. And they've kind of added facilities for that into Pages and the ebook in the EPUB publishing space, but it's not quite at the same level. But you have to weigh that like slight functional win over the fact that iBooks Author was basically underdeveloped and no one used it, right? So I think streamlining here, I'm way less mad about like them getting rid of iTunes U and iBooks Author than I was about them stopping doing airport routers, right? Like,
yeah.
The airport routers is way more central to their business and they dropped those. And this kind of like flummery on the edges that was also basically being superseded by three other projects Apple had, it kind of felt like cruft that, you know, the typically streamlined company needs to shed, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I've never seen iTunes U be developed before in all the time I've watched Apple. I don't know if you've noticed any changes in your time.
It got a few updates in the 2014 time period.
Okay.
Right around when they were trying to do the 2013 textbook stuff. Right. So it got a bit of attention there, but then it slowly fell off a cliff. And then when they started doing the iPad for Education, a renewed effort starting in 2017 was the first 329 iPad, I believe. And mm-hmm. Then they started migrating to the Classroom and the Schoolwork apps, and iTunes U was forgotten about.
But having seen iBooks Author from the moment of unveil to now this is gone, that one does feel a little, I mean, it hits a little bit closer to home, and it can kind of see and have more of an opinion about that, because it was a big deal when it came out. There were early challenges, like the books are only for the iPad, and then you could do books for the iPhone as well. And then you'd hear from the people like my friend David Sparks, who actually made these books for the iPad and like sold them as like part of his business. The app, it seems like several years ago, like maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, the app was just, the big takeaway from people who relied on it was that it would just crash, and it was underdeveloped for an app that had such a big purpose to it. And it's so weird to see, like, I mean, it almost feels like if Apple were to take like Pages, Keynote, or Numbers, and so like, we're not gonna do that anymore. You know, you could see, well, there's a bunch of alternatives to that, but for iBooks Author, they tried it, they did a little bit to it, and then it didn't go anywhere, and it just lingered for so long. And then we could see this coming whenever Pages got the update to do EPUB. And I know my friend David Smith Sparks at the time was like, okay, I'm done with iBooks Author now, because from what I'm hearing, it will never be reliable and it will never get better than it is. And we're finally at that moment where that's spoken from Apple.
With PDF Pen 12, it's the ultimate tool for editing PDFs on the Mac, and it's available right now. If you're looking to go beyond preview with document editing, then PDF Pen is for you. Go paperless with scanning and optical character recognition, mark up PDFs, redact sensitive info, add headers, footers, watermark your documents, correct text in PDFs, add pages, move it around images without even owning the original document. PDF Pen has been a staple of the Mac platform for years, and now they're out with a brand new version, version 12. PDF Pen 12 includes stationery, so you can customize with new paper colors and create custom page designs. There's a new magnifier feature, a new magnifier window that makes it super easy to zoom around and zoom up close on the mouse pointer. There's built-in support for DocuSign, which is a very popular platform for having legal documents signed, contracts signed, etc. Support for digitally signing PDFs. New compression settings, so you can have more control over the output PDF file. And of course, PDF Pen for Mac has always been a great steward of the Apple platform. It supports features like Continuity Camera on the Mac with full compatibility for Catalina. And on the iPad, you can use PDF Pen on iOS 13 using the Apple Pencil to refine document editing. And as well as PDF Pen, they also have PDF Pen Pro, which is the more advanced version. And it adds ability to create forms, edit table contents, export to Microsoft Excel if you want to be all business-like, you know, all those kind of features. There's a whole lot more to these incredible apps. Go beyond preview and learn more about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro at smilesoftware.com/podcast. That's smilesoftware.com/podcast. Thanks to PDF Pen for sponsoring Happy Hour.
Something I've learned from this past hour, you know, we started doing the YouTube live stream at the same time for this podcast episode at the same time as the Sony PlayStation 5 event. And we're getting ready to wrap up here in a few minutes. And from what I can tell, there's no console reveal yet. So we're doing great. This was like and it reminds me of like the WWDC events that are so game demo heavy, except, you know, this is naturally a game console, so it's all game demos, so it's more
appropriate. Luckily Apple's kind of got away from those kind of like snore fests, right? Whereas the rest of the industry, E3, games console announcements, they're very similar.
Yeah, so maybe we can do this again for the PlayStation 6 in a decade and do a pre-show for that. A few more things to talk about before we go away for the week, which is one, there's new Apple Watch band colors and iPhone cases. I haven't got the, well, I do have the names in front of me, but I would just describe them as like a brown color, a blue color, a green color, and an orange color. And they're called Vitamin C, Coastal Gray, Seafoam Sport, and Linen Blue. So those are both new Apple Watch Sport band colors and iPhone case colors. What we didn't see was anything from that leather loop leak that we, you know, really don't know what to make of yet. Although my thought on that was it probably to have a new style of band like that would be marketed with a new Apple Watch so that it looks newer than just new colors, especially when the case design isn't expected to change this year. So I wouldn't rule it out yet. It's just weird that it would show up so far ahead of time. And then also this sort of comes from Mark earlier, but it's that we expect that Apple will be doing financing with the Apple Card on more than just, I guess now it's the iPhone, right? And with the Barclay Card that it replaced in the U.S., that there was many more financing options for whether it's for Mac or for other devices over time.
So, sure. So on the iPhone at the moment, you can get Apple Card financing for 24 months. So if you buy a new iPhone with Apple Card monthly payments, you pay, you know, whatever the cost of the iPhone is divided by 24, and each of those repayments are not added to your interest payable balance. So you basically get interest-free repayments. If after the 2 years you haven't paid off your phone, it just goes onto your Apple Card at the standard rate, which is what, between like 10 to 25%, somewhere in that range. But for the 2 years, you get it for free. And it's all done automatically and integrated into the Apple Card UI, Apple Wallet. I mean, so, you know, it's a nice experience. Mm-hmm. And clearly, Apple did that to help juice iPhone sales, because being able to buy an iPhone more easily in segments over time versus one big upfront payment helps make Apple's products more accessible to more people, because most, you know, a lot more people can afford a monthly payment versus buying a thing all in one wallop. And so that's the logic where they've been offering various deals with, you know, Barclay Card and others around the world for financing for the Macs and stuff for a long time. But as the Apple Card gets up and running, you know, we predicted last year that slowly Goldman Sachs and Apple's contracts would mean that all of these random financing plans that Apple has with all these different companies are slowly being unified into one thing. And this is the next step in that. And so what Mark reported actually was that although the iPhone program is 24 months, they're going to offer a 12-month 0% interest on products like iPad, Mac, Apple Pencil, Pro Display XDR, and then 6 months interest-free plans for cheaper products like AirPods or Apple TV and the HomePod. Mm-hmm. Again, it would work in the same mechanism where you buy it through the Apple Store, you say, add it to my Apple Card, and then you get the monthly payment period for free, and then it adds onto your balance at the end if you haven't paid it all off. And of course, as well as these plans and availability of finance helping Apple sell hardware, they also just raise visibility and adoption of the Apple Card itself, because long term, Apple makes some money. You know, it's small pennies or whatever, but over time it adds up on your Apple Card transactions. So the more people in the US they can get signed up to the Apple Card, the more money they make that way as well. So that's why these 0% offers exist. Like a lot of the time, a credit card will give you 0% for 12 months as like a sign up bonus, right? And so they exist because they know they're going to make money from you in the long term. And you know, the financial engineering there applies to the Apple Card as well. Right now, it's a shame that the Apple Card's only available in the United States. And so this financing plan, the Apple financing plan, will only be available in the US, obviously. But, you know, Goldman Sachs and Apple have shown interest in expanding internationally. We're just kind of waiting for that to happen. And you know what banking's like. It's a slow process.
That's right, yeah. And then finally this week, we had a section in the notes called What We Don't Know About WWDC 2020 Presentation Yet. And it became what we now know about WWDC 2020. And that's because they announced sort of the schedule this week. And it's no surprise at all kind of how it goes. But it does answer the question of, like, will it be pre-recorded, you know, or will it be live streamed from an actual sort of event? And then people had ideas that maybe there'd be like limited press there. From what we understand, there's not that, but there is more than
press.
Yeah, there is more than just, you know, here's a bunch of videos that we prepared. Which is a big aspect of it, I think, but not for the keynote, right?
Yes. So the schedule that they announced was that the keynote starts on the Monday, which is June 22nd. Of course, 9 to 5 Mac happy hour, and all the rest of us at 9 to 5 Mac will bring you full coverage of that. But the event keynote's on the Monday at 10 a.m. That's the normal time. And normally they would hold that in like the McHenry Convention Center and have, you know, 5,000 developers all together in one room. Obviously, because of the pandemic, that doesn't happen. But we're wondering, were they going to just like pre-record a keynote, or are they going to have like, you know, Nintendo Direct style videos? Their wording here seems to rule out both of those options, because they say the keynote address will stream directly from Apple Park, and you'll be able to watch it on the Apple website, through the Apple Developer app, through the Apple TV app, or on YouTube. I think that's cool. Like, I think ideally that's what they were going for. We talked about this before, right? What we prefer them to do. I think having a stage element isn't... Oh, well, I'm assuming they're going to do it on the stage. They don't actually say Steve Jobs Theater here. They just say from Apple Park.
Sure, so yeah.
They could, because the you know, the video on the racial $100 million commitment that Tim Cook did today was recorded from Apple Park, but it wasn't recorded in Steve Jobs Theater. It was recorded in like this glass room, right? You could see it in the background. So, you know, there's an outside chance that they have the event streaming from like Tim's office, maybe. Like, do you know what I mean? They have the theater on site, and with so many employees going back starting on the 15th, there is time for them to like prep the theater, even in a socially distanced way. So I presume that's what they're going for, but they don't actually promise a theater appearance in the press release, just to be, you know, fastidious in what they've said.
Indeed, yeah. If they do pull off a theater presentation that's live, I mean, you know, have Apple Park staff who are there sitting, you know, every fifth seat or so and maintaining their distance from each other, that's enough to... I mean, you only need the front row and a mic to have the applause, really. And then in terms of just like looking back on the keynote, or just viewing from home, like it would just look very normal, I think, right? Like,
yeah, like you don't need to do much, I think, to make it fit in. Like you'd probably see, rather than Tim and Craig Federighi doing this, they'll probably be doing this, right? Just to stay separated.
Who gets the clicker? Who passes it off?
Exactly.
Everyone uses their watch clicker instead.
Yeah, they need more than one clicker. But on the whole, like they could probably get like a pretty similar thing, even if they do have more, you know, more passing over to videos during the actual show. Like, say if they have these features that they want to demo rather than doing a live demo, they may just show a video. But I think it's nice to have like Tim come on the stage and actually introduce stuff, right? Like it just gives it that personal touch that it is actually been doing live rather than just like videos that have been finessed to the nth degree, which is what it sounds like the rest of the week's going to be, because they say the platform State of the Union, which is kind of like the developer keynote, that's the afternoon on the Monday, but they don't say that will come from Apple Park. So that's going to be like videos recorded at home, and then for the remainder of the week they're going to do home recorded videos as well. One thing that is interesting in this announcement is they did actually announce they're going to redesign the developer forums. So part of the WWC experience is like the contact you get with the labs and the engineering teams at Apple to get help with your problems if you're a developer. And so they've kind of addressed that here. They say they're going to do new developer forums, which launch on the June 18th, so that's next week. And let me tell you, right now, the developer forums are a joke, okay? They have a bad reputation of basically being useless. Not so much the design, I guess, although the design is pretty dated. It's more the fact that no Apple developer really frequents the forums that much. There are a few, but most forum threads on the Apple developer forums, there's just like 100 questions and 2 of them have been answered, right? Do you know what I mean? So as well as them being redesigned, I hope they just put more like staff on board to actually discuss stuff. They even say that starting on the first day of WWDC, anyone can search to follow along, and Apple developer program members will be able to post their own questions and learn directly from Apple engineering. So hopefully if they do actually connect those together more, they can provide a lot of the experience virtually of what normal WWDC would be. They've also said that by appointment, some developers will be able to get labs. So you'll be able to get one-on-one time, like like a short 10-minute chat or something on a specific problem. It basically just sounds like you have to send an email and say, I need to help on this. And then someone will hopefully try and schedule you in somewhere along the week. But obviously, they can't. You know, normally they're catering to 5,000 people. They're actually, what, like 20 million Apple developers? So
right.
they're gonna have to pick and choose, ultimately, right? Like, they can't.
And you pay a lot of money to get that access, and right now it's free for this year to have any of this. So there's no way they could replicate what the normal experience in terms of what happens after the keynote and after the State of the Union address, recreate that virtually for free without, you know, and it would, I think it definitely better than if they were to like charge for a select number of people, and then it feels even less inclusive. So
yeah. Like, I'm really excited for WWC, obviously on the developer side as well as the consumer side.
Me too. Yeah.
The ARM stuff, like we obviously spoke about it with a bit of Mark at the start of the show, but I think it just makes, like, there's been a lot of talk this week about, like, is it really the right thing for it to do? Is Apple just going to have loads of software churn and app compatibility incompatibility problems? Like, yes, there are trade-offs, but I feel like, you know, the switch from Intel to ARM affects a lot of, like, esoteric little niches in a bad way. But for the core mainstream community, it's just like a win all around. You're going to get faster chips in hardware that can have much longer battery life or be thinner. And for Apple, they're going to ultimately spend less money because right now they have to pay Intel fees for every single chip. In the long term, their R&D into making Mac chips will deplenish and go away. And so it'll be cheaper for them. Plus, they're getting better chips that are at least as performant, if not more efficient, and in some ways more performant. I think Mark's story specifically mentioned like AI, machine learning, and the GPU for the chip that's coming out in whichever product it is starting next year. And they get roadmap flexibility, just like what we've seen with the A device, the A series processors in iOS devices. They're going to have that with the Macs too. So they're no longer really going to be beholden to the Intel roadmap to actually ship products that they want to. Like the Retina MacBook Air has been widely reported to have been held back partly because of Intel's chip delays, right? Mm-hmm. So whereas if you take it all under your own roof and the chips that are running the laptops are the Apple chips too, they can obviously sync those things up. So, you know, when iPhone 10 comes out, they have the chip ready that supports Face ID to go. And when they have, you know, a similar innovation coming to the Mac, they can have those things synced up because they're all under one roof. They're not beholden to third parties for such a fundamental element. So I think it's a massive win. Like, I don't think there are people scared, like, oh, you know, some old apps aren't going to work. But it sounded like Mark said they are going to offer some kind of emulation. So there'll at least be some, you know, bridge to the modern world. Like the cons are massively outweighed by the pros, right? And as soon as they have a Mac laptop, I'd love to own it because I think it'd be a really nice machine.
Yeah,
a Mac ARM laptop. Yeah. You'll be buying a Mac ARM laptop, right? Like, why not?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I was a big fan. The problem for me is that the overlap in what the machines do. So I'm having a really good time with the 16-inch MacBook Pro for what it is. I really enjoy how versatile it is. Like right now, I can be plugged into two external 4K displays. And then from here, I can unplug and like work on this in a different room. Or it can go, you know, on a trip with me and be like the mobile office. So it's got that like high ceiling of like what it can do versus like the average of what it needs to do. And that even has me questioning, like, you know, the new iMac, whatever that ends up being, redesign is probably the most compelling thing there. But then there's also the 23-inch iMac rumor too that came before this. And I was thinking, well, that would be like the always on machine at home. You know, you still have a Mac Mini for that purpose in 2012. So I think there's some room in what I do to have an always on Mac running at home for things like backing up iCloud photos, or having the full library there and then having that backup somewhere else. That's the biggest appeal, really. I couldn't resist one for the sake of work. I would try one out, probably by buying it. And then, you know, just to have an idea of like, what is this
well,
like?
You used to own the 12-inch, right?
Yeah.
Which you liked, right? Because you thought it was super portable, but it was just slow, right?
I didn't feel like it was slow because I used it every day, and it was just the pace that it was. And with how I was using it, it didn't get bogged down. For me, it was new machines came out that were, you know, wanted to try out, and it ended up being probably better in different situations. But like single port, that's what the iPad is, you know, and people can work with the iPad today. Really, it's tough for me to criticize that, except for the keyboard over time. Like even the typing experience, I loved from the first day, but just the durability over time is what was tricky with that. Imagine it got hot.
A 12-inch MacBook with scissor switches, so the keyboard's sorted, and it's as fast as like your 16-inch MacBook Pro, and its battery life is like twice as long. Like, what's not to like?
You know, my dream has for the longest time has been the something as large as the 16-inch MacBook. I want a big screen and I want portability. I don't care that much about power when it's a laptop versus a desktop. So that maybe this is like a long-term thing that happens over time, but that eventually like the portability and, you know, no fan, all that stuff comes to the 16-inch MacBook. So the first one I think probably won't be for me, but if they get to a point where it's like, it's just incredible, that they've got like a 16-inch version with just incredible power. And it has all those things like the fan, it doesn't need a fan, like how an iPad doesn't need a fan, even though it's super powerful. That would be for me because, I mean,
and that's not a question we're going to get answered this month because
that's right.
They're going to announce the chip transition and then the first product's going to ship, what, like optimistically April?
Yeah.
But that's only going to be probably just like an Air replacement laptop. And it's really unclear, you know, is it going to be 2 years for them to do higher-end machines? It's going to be 3 years for them to do iMac. Do you know what I mean? Like, whereas with the Intel transition, they move very, very fast. It just doesn't seem like they're going to be able to do that this time. So we're going to be in this like dual Intel ARM world of Macs for a long time, and that'll be fine. Like, Apple will support Intel Macs as long as they support them today, right? They'll just carry on, and you'll eventually fall off the. They'll support like 3 years of operating systems that support Intel, maybe more. And then they'll eventually have ones that only run on ARM and don't run on Intel. But for as long as like the Mac Pro is going to require Intel chips, they're going to have to keep supporting dual architecture operating systems. So
yeah. And then as for next week, so next week is the last episode before we get to WWDC as of like what happened in the event. So next week, I think we'll dedicate the entire episode to what we, you know, have reported is coming, what we believe is coming, just really
some wishes.
Yeah, and just really exhaustively, because I think, you know, just even talking to Mark earlier, like a lot of the stuff from a December build to March reports has been a long time now. Like, so many things have happened since then. So it'll be good to kind of recap everything that we reported throughout this year and then given, you know, put in some requests and things like that. So looking forward to that. And I'm glad now that we have. There's no surprise on like when is WWDC based on, you know, the start of the week, how will the keynote work? It's pretty standard, but it feels much more real now and having that have a date and everything. So I'm hyped.
Same.
Yep. And for our live video watchers, we were an hour and 15 minutes into recording and the PS5 event that began. As we began, it just now got to the reveal. So it's kind of like if it was all just content. So it's kind of like the Apple TV event. And then the end of it would be like, and here's a new Apple TV. So hope you guys enjoyed that. Let's see. So I think we're going to wrap up for the week. So again, we'll be back next week. Next week, we will broadcast at the same time. So for our live viewers and listeners, that is 4 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. Just go to 9to5Mac.com and you can find the link, or it'll be on youtube.com/9to5Mac. And, you know, I think I also want to do some questions and answers next week too. So if you have any, then come in, and that'll be the best way to send them is through YouTube.
Or you can tweet us during the week.
Yeah, you can tweet us in the week, but I like the people that come live. So for anybody, thanks for listening. And if you're new to the podcast, then please, I request that you subscribe, because you'll get new episodes every week as soon as they appear. And we love doing this stuff. So, all right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. We will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.